theorem has been called by some people the fundamental theorem of complex dynamics. And yeah, I think this is very, very true. We have a number of deep theorems in complex dynamics, but this is perhaps among the deep theorems the one which has universal use, in contrast to some theorems, for example, about the Mandelbrot set or so, which are extremely deep, extremely powerful and difficult, but which are restricted to certain contexts. And this, at least for rational functions, is a very versatile and universal theorem. Understanding is one thing. Using it is yet another thing. Every time, or most of the time that this theorem is used, this is a theorem in its own right. And there are many deep people, deep papers in the field which start with this theorem and then do something, prove something, classification or description. So it's not just that this theorem answers a question. In some sense, it is a tool towards doing something else. I should also say that this theorem is a member of a family of at least three or four theorems, all by Thurston, which are all very different on the first glance, and all very similar somehow under the hood. So this is his characterization theorem of rational maps. Then there's a theorem on surface automorphisms, classifying automorphisms of surfaces. Then in the hyperbolization theorems that many three-dimensional manifolds have a hyperbolic structure. All these theorems have a common underlying idea, which can perhaps be paraphrased as saying you start with some topological information, and then either this topological information has a geometric, or this topological skeleton has a geometric realization, or it doesn't. Well, so far it's easy. And then there's a precise meaning to this, or it doesn't. And this does mean there is an obstruction of a certain kind. And this obstruction often is a kind of combinatorial topological condition that gives you information about the situation. So coming back to complex dynamics, one typical use is the beauty of complex dynamics is the adjective complex within the setting of dynamical systems. And the complex structure adds a lot of stiffness and rigidity, which makes it much easier to classify things and give precise statements, which would be inconceivable if you had topological or differentiable, just differentiable maps in the real sense. For example, if you have a map from the two-sphere to itself, which is one point which is forward and backward invariant. There's a huge space of such topological mappings. But as soon as you know it's complex differentiable, it's a polynomial. And it's a finite dimensional parameter space. So this is this is a static theorem, it's just a map. And in dynamics, it often allows to have an error. You start with combinatorics allows you to build some topological model, up to topology, perhaps. Well, let's not be so rigid, up to homotopy. And then there's a complex map. And this principle pervades much of complex dynamics, at least one-dimensional complex dynamics. You can specify some combinatorics and describe in an essentially unique sense the holomorphic map. And this step is, in many ways, Thurston's theorem. You can classify polynomials in terms of external angles, for example, or in terms of Hubbard trees. You have a polynomial, a quadratic polynomial. There's the Hubbard tree, perhaps the critical orbit does this, sixth, or whatever. Just knowing some topological data, the tree could look something like this, up to topology, is enough to specify a unique quadratic polynomial. And the same is true in higher degrees. Or you could specify the polynomial in terms of external rays, let me call them green again, landing at the critical value and then the forward orbit, just knowing the external angle, is this, maybe it's 956 in this example, just one number, combinatorics, specifies the angles. If you know this ray at angle 9 over 56 lands at the critical value, is enough information, I'll show this later on, to specify the polynomial uniquely. The same thing, the tree is topological, but if you have the tree up to deformations, it's just the combinatorial data that find the many critical points on the critical orbit, how they're connected on the tree, it's a finite amount of combinatorial data. Construct the topology, and then Thurston tells you. In this case, you don't need it, but Thurston is a way of telling you that there exists a unique polynomial, realizing this. Other applications include Newton's method. For example, you can classify Newton's method for polynomials as a rational map in terms of combinatorics. Ask Johannes about this. Okay, there's always open questions, of course. Then people have worked on matings. You want to take two polynomials, each essentially on a disk. You glue the disks together, remove something, get a sphere, and then you have a rational function. And then you want to show that rational functions, many of them can be understood in terms of gluing two polynomials. One important step is always to construct a rational function with these properties. And one way of doing this, you describe the combinatorics of the polynomials, describe the topology of the combinatorics of the rational function, and then say, okay, such a function exists. And then you check it has the required properties. Okay, here's somebody who's trying to extend this result in greater generality. But yes, there are limitations to Thurston's theorem. Can you raise the issue in the end again, then we can see what is being done beyond the current stage of this polynomial? Okay, so this, it's not the final word on complex dynamics, but it is a very useful theorem. Okay, let me read it for you. If G, a map from the two-sphere to itself, is a branched cover with finite critical orbits and hyperbolic orbifold, then either this map G is Thurston equivalent to a rational map, which is necessarily unique up to Möbius conjugation, or G has a Thurston obstruction. Okay, so what do we need to explain in order for this to make sense? Two-sphere is just a topological object, no complex structures, just a statement in the topological category. A branched covering, finite degree, it's branched over finitely many points. So PG is the post-critical set. These are the ramification values. Something like the topological critical values and their forward orbit. So this is something you can iterate. And these orbits are, by assumption, finite. And as Misha pointed out, this is a severe restriction. But post-singularly finite maps are the most important ones for many cases. And then, so this is what you start with, and then you want to move on afterwards. Okay, so this, I hope, please ask questions if I'm unclear. But I hope so far this is just easy. Then we come to the word hyperbolic orbifold. Let me just say, such a branch covering has a hyperbolic orbifold unless it's one out of finitely many exceptions. I don't want to spend too much time on this. The finitely many exceptions, which are all classified by hand, there is no question about them. And especially this is true if the number of the points in the PG is at least 5. So problems can be only if the post-singular set is at most 4 points, and there isn't too much to be said about those. Okay, next comes the definition of Thurston equivalent. When is a map Thurston equivalent to a rational function? And then comes the question about what is the Thurston obstruction. Citizen equivalence is easy to define. It takes a little more time to explain why this is the concept you want. So, G is such a branch covering from S2 to itself, and PG is the post-critical set, which is forward invariant, and F is another map which could be a branch covering like this, or it could already be a rational map. Then I want to have a commutative diagram between G and F using two homeomorphisms C and C. So the equivalent, if there are such homeomorphisms from the sphere to itself, which are the same maps, so I want that C equals C of PG equals PF. They send the post-critical set from here to the post-critical set from here. Both of them are the same maps on the post-critical set. If they were the same maps everywhere, F and G would simply be topologically conjugate. I'm not saying this. C and G can be different, but they should be homotopic or isotopic relative to the post-critical set, PG. Let me make one statement why asking for a topological conjugation would be unreasonable. Suppose this is a rational function, and this is a branch covering, this map here, then this could well have fixed points. It must have fixed points just by topological reasons. And there's nothing which prevents you here from having an open set of fixed points or periodic points. Topology allows this, and topology has no problems with this. Complex analysis has a problem with this. You cannot have an open set of fixed points for holomorphic functions unless it's the identity. So this is a condition. If you only specify this much of information, you cannot reasonably expect to have a topological conjugation. You must request something weaker, and this is exactly the right amount of information you want to require. Okay. I hope that board moves up. Okay. That takes care of the Thurston equivalence. So now I have to define a Thurston abstraction. Let me roll up my sleeves. That requires a number of further words. I need a multicurve, or a simple closed curve, gamma in S2 minus the post-critical set G is essential. So it's a Jordan curve cutting the sphere into two disks. If each of the two both components of S2 minus G contain at least two points in PZ. You want to look at only those points. For those of you who want to read things up, there is the famous paper by Dewitt and Hubbard explaining the theorem, published after Mathematica in 93. And I should say I'm deviating a little from their notation. They distinguish non-essential and peripheral curves. But for our purposes, it's essentially the same. So, what your intuition should be for these essential, for these simple closed curves, is using moduli of annuli, you have the sphere. You have so many points, and the whole bottom line of the theorem, and maybe the most important statement I'm making altogether in describing the theorem is, if you have a simple closed curve like this, and suppose this was a complex sphere, so you have a complex structure, you can surround this curve by an annulus, a complex annulus. Every annulus has a modulus, conformally equivalent to a round annulus between radius capital R and little r, and then the modulus is simply essentially the ratio of the two radii, and then you can measure it in different terms. You want it to be additive, and then forget the decorations, it's the ratio, how thick it is between inner and outer radii. And the question is how big such an annulus, how fat an annulus, fits in this homotopy class. And the contradiction is if there is too fat an annulus. If you have a curve like this, then you have arbitrarily big annuli in this homotopy class. There is no restriction. Similarly, a curve which surrounds only a single point has annuli of arbitrarily big moduli in the homotopy class. So all these have no problem. They say nothing. But if you surround two points, and have two points in the complement, then if the points here are fixed, then there is a natural limit for the size of the modulus of this annulus. And that's what we're going to look at all the time. This is the bottom line of the whole theorem. And contradictions happen only in this direction. So we have to look at curves for which it's meaningful to have this limitation. And therefore, this definition of essential simple closed curves. So a multi-curve, where's my chalk? Red. It's a finite collection. Let me call this capital gamma. Gamma 1 up to gamma n of essential simple closed curves. Which are disjoint. This curve gamma is invariant, G invariant, if each component of F inverse of gamma I, the preimage of every curve is up to, if D is the degree, it's up to D curve, simple closed curves. Could be fewer if some of them have higher mapping degree. If each component of this is either inessential or in gamma. So you forget the components which play no role, which are inessential, of which you cannot say anything, and the rest should be from the same finite collection. Now we need the Thurston matrix, M gamma of gamma has entries Mij every index runs through the elements of the multicurve, so that Mij is the sum over all K. These are components of F inverse of gamma I or J, does it matter? I think J, homotopic to, so you take its index ij, second index is J, take curve gamma J, take the preimages under F, them is up to K of them, you see which of them are homotopic to gamma I, if any. There might be several. And then 1 over the degree of the map, what's G? G, let me call this gamma ij k from gamma ij k to gamma, sorry, this is gamma j k perhaps. So the pre-image component could wind several times around gamma j. So there's a mapping degree one or more than one. You take one over the degree, add this up for the various contributions from gamma k, from the pre-images, which are on top of gamma I. You add this up. This gives you some non-negative real entries, and that defines the square matrix, M gamma. So this is a real N by N matrix. And its leading eigenvalue by Perron-Frobenius theory, its leading eigenvalue, lambda gamma, is real. It's a non-negative real number, is a leading eigenvalue. I see now I can define a Thurston obstruction. Gamma is a Thurston obstruction by definition, if this eigenvalue is at least one or greater. So in a little more than 20 minutes, I've at least written down the statement of the theorem, hopefully. Am I missing anything? Which little gamma? Of this one, yes. Thank you. Yes, always, I'm only talking about G's at this point here, yes. It's G invariant if we have a G here. Okay, more contributions? Doesn't matter, you can. If you don't have them disjoint and you can make them disjoint by homotopy, then you do it and then we start again. That doesn't matter. Okay. That's a theorem. Yes, that's important. Or in gamma up to. Everything is up to homotopy here. Up to homotopy always rel the postcritical set. So, if you've seen this 10 times, and if you know what it means, then you will understand. I've taken a while, I think many people have taken a while, and Dudi Hubbard writes this also, to come to terms with what this means. Maybe I will deviate from my planned concept and try to first make sense why this is a meaningful statement and why. Let me start with the proof, without anything. One direction is relatively easy and one is not. But the easy direction gives a justification for what this whole thing means. Why you want to look at these things, and also why people can remember funny formulas like this. All you need is the Grütsch inequality. Is that familiar? If you have two nested annuli then of moduli mu1 and mu2, then the union of the two, so there's one annulus like this, and there's another one like this. This is modulus mu1, this is modulus mu2, and then I just take the annulus from outside, from the outermost boundary to the innermost boundary, and the combined modulus is at least the sum of the two. This is the Grütsch. The hardest part of this inequality is the spelling of the name. This is Grütsch. It's a very local branch of a name from the middle of Germany. So let me try to convince you that this is a reasonable statement. It's only up to homotopy. And I don't think in this picture you can see the degrees of. Okay. I'll let you answer your own question. So, I said earlier, when you think about essential curves, what you really should think about is annuli, moduli of annuli. So here is a curve, gamma 1, and really it is an annulus. We call this A1. Suppose we have a rational function. G is a rational function, and we want to see, I want to show that a rational function cannot have a Thurston obstruction. With hyperbolic orbifold, this is what I'm trying to show for you. So this multicurve, think of it as an annulus, has a pre-image somewhere. So there's one annulus perhaps like this, which maps to this one. Let's look at if this is modulus mu1, and then this is modulus mu1 prime, perhaps. Then mu1 prime is mu1 if you have a mapping degree 1. It's a conformal isomorphism, and the modulus is invariant in the conformal isomorphisms. But it could as well wrap around several times, and then the modulus changes according to the mapping degree. And what you get is the degree here, from A1 prime to A1 with the obvious notations here. Elementary exercise on moduli. So the modulus in this direction divides simply by the mapping degree from here to here. Let me look at a very simple case of a Thurston obstruction, in which the multicurve consists of a single curve. So the Thurston matrix is a 1x1 matrix. Easy to imagine. It's a number. So suppose it's this multicurve. You have one pre-image here, which we ignore, it's not essential. There might be further non-essential ones. But suppose there is one here. After all, so if all of them were inessential, then the Thurston matrix would be 0, and the leading eigenvalue is 0. It wouldn't be a Thurston obstruction. So suppose the leading eigenvalue is 2 for this 1x1 matrix. That means the entry in the matrix is 2. So we have some number of pre-images of the curve gamma, homotopy to gamma, so that this sum here equals 2. The easiest way to accomplish this is say there's mapping degree 1, then every entry gives us a 1, so we need to have 2 of those. So there's another 1, pre-images are always disjoint. This is 1 and this is 1. Both of them have the same modulus as the original one. So if I unite them together with everything in between, I get a fat annulus between the outer and inner boundary with at least twice, and the Gwitch inequality helps us here, with at least twice the initial modulus. Okay, so I have a bigger annulus in the same homotopy class. Can do the same thing. And in the next step, I get again at least twice the previous annulus. But now, remember, essential curves are those curves for which there's a universal bound on the annulus of any modulus of any annulus in this homotopy class. So there's a contradiction. We get bigger and bigger in a bounded set. We get unboundedly bigger in a bounded space. That's a contradiction. A Thurston obstruction wants to produce very big annuli, and an infinitely big annulus on the Riemann sphere possible if and only if at least one of the two complementary components is a single point. which we exactly excluded by the definition of essential. There's one, let's wait for a moment. I won't answer the question, but I won't answer it later. So this was the case if the mapping degree was one for a single curve. If you have several curves, it's just a matter of combinatorics. This matrix tells you all the preimages of gamma j are wherever they are. Look at all of them homotopy to gamma i, and then all the annuli have this modulus times the initial one. So this entry gives us the contribution of the preimages of gamma j in the homotopy class of gamma I, if you only look at those. Is that clear, or shall I repeat it? You take all, here's the matrix M gamma, and here are the annulus and the modulus mu 1, mu 2, up to mu n. This is the vector of the moduli in the various, in the homotopy classes. Every gamma I is surrounded by an annulus, and these are the moduli. And then M gamma times this vector is a new vector, mu 1 prime up to mu n prime. And every entry here is the contribution of all those pre-images under the map G, taking the various mapping degrees into account and adding the various contributions with the grid inequality, we get this inequality. So it may happen that many contributions all come together from different parts. It's just a matter of bookkeeping the various annuli and the moduli. So this is at least as big as this. This is the map F, or G, or whatever. It's the same for our purposes. So you take a pre-image, and then there's many pre-images, like this. Okay, so this is the old collection of moduli, and the new collection is at least M gamma times the old one. If the leading eigenvalue is greater than 1, then if you iterate this, this thing will become unbounded, and you have the same contradiction, even more general combinatorial conditions. If the leading eigenvalue is equal to 1, it's still not possible. There are several arguments for this. One is described in the paper. Another one for the experts, you can start, there's a unique rational function which has a maximal modulus in this homotopy class. But if you start somewhere in Teichmuller space, so underlying this iteration in Teichmuller space, I'm talking to the experts now, then no matter where you start, you would converge to this unique map. And moduli at least cannot get smaller. However, if you start somewhere where you have extremely big annulus in this homotopy class, you can never get to the fixed point, which is a contradiction. And an argument for the rest of us in a simple case, suppose I have an invariant simple closed curve, let me call this simply gamma. Suppose the first obstruction is simply the matrix 1. I'm going to sketch a different argument for the case lambda equal to 1 in this special case, which does not use the argument I just used for Rodrigo. So then the map F, I take pre-images from here to here, take pre-images. This map, so I'm using the word hyperbolic orbifold fold in the sense that the post-critical set is, well, at least 4 points. Should be 5. I'm not going to worry about this for the moment. So I have at least 4 punctures here. There's a hyperbolic metric in the Riemann sphere minus the post-critical set. I take a preimage on the holomorphic map. This is P1 minus the image, free image of the fourth critical set. These are more points, and it's a holomorphic covering. It's an unbranched covering, because I've taken all the post-critical points here. Therefore, locally, it's an isometry for the hyperbolic metric, and this curve has some pre-image component, gamma prime, which has the same length as this one. Let me use the simple closed curve in this homotopy class. So it's the simple geodesic. The geodesic in this homotopy class, which is the shortest curve in this homotopy class. Then here, the pre-image has the same length because it's the hyperbolic covering. And I'm removing a few points, the pre-post-critical points. And the lengths get shorter. So inclusion, holomorphic inclusions always are shorter. And therefore, I have a curve in the same homotopy class, which is shorter than before, which is, again, a contradiction. Okay? So that's the extremal case if lambda is equal to 1. So, I hope I've given you some idea of what, of the one direction, of what the words say in this theorem, including the definition, where they're coming from, and at least that there's a relation between the hypothesis and the conclusion of the theorem, in the sense that if you have a Thurston abstraction here, then there can be no holomorphic function. No holomorphic function can have a Thurston abstraction if the hyperbolic or before this hyperbolic. So let me try to give you some ideas of what's going on, and I would like to move in the end over and show you spiders, which are a simpler way perhaps of looking at Thurston's theorem, and motivate what I have not done is motivate the definition for Thurston equivalence. I'm trying to get there in a moment. Let's try to invent this theorem. It's too complicated to understand, so let's try to reinvent it on our own. I have the function g, I have the function f, which is supposed to be equivalent. This could be, say, a polynomial. This is the polynomial here. And this is the topological branched covering. There's S2 with the post-critical set here. There's S2 with, could be the complex plane with the post-critical set if it's holomorphic already, like this. And if they want to be equivalent, well, there's certainly homeomorphism phi from the sphere, from the topological sphere to the Riemann sphere. And there's a chance for them to be equivalent only if the post-critical sets coincide. In other words, if we have the same number of critical points, the same degrees of the critical points, and then the same kind of orbits, so that the one is periodic with period 7, the next is pre-periodic with pre-period 3, and then 2, and then this critical orbit hops onto that one after 7 steps. So the combinatorics of the critical orbits should be the same. So we have, in particular, all the critical values from here mapped to critical values from here with the same degrees. That is all you need to lift this to a homeomorphism. There's a new homeomorphism psi which makes this diagram commute. Let's forget generality. Let's talk about quadratic polynomials for the sake of simplicity. Then you have quadratic polynomials have two critical points, two critical values, which are distinct, of degree 2, and one of the critical points is even fixed. It's the point at infinity. So both of them have two critical values, which are identified, and it's just a 2-to-1 covering on the annulus between them. And in this case, it should be pretty obvious that you can lift this homeomorphism. On the sphere minus 2 points, you have a 2-to-1 map, you have an injective map, you have a 2-to-1 map in the inverse. It's this lifting of coverings. So there's a homeomorphism which you can fix here. Whenever you have such a homeomorphism, you can lift it up, and it's just a matter of having the same combinatorics. And now what, suppose we start with a specific example, as I said up here, want to construct a polynomial with given, say, external angles. Now I need four of them for a commutative diagram. Let me use a different one, maybe 3 over 15. Well, this is the polynomial 3, like this, like this. So we know this should be 3 angles, 3 over 15, 6 over 15, which is 2 over 5. Well, let's forget that. No cancellation. This is power of 2 minus 1. Then this is 12 over 15, and then 24 over 15 is 9 over 15 times 2 is 18. 18 is the same as 3. And we have the same thing down here. And of course, we have our polynomial F mapping this. So that's the polynomial that we want to have. Let's just sketch it. I mean, I sketched it here. So all we can do is draw it like this and hope it's approximately right. It's already wrong here. It doesn't really matter. Okay, so we've sketched this. We want a polynomial where this ray maps to this, maps to this, maps to this. Here's the critical point and here's the critical value. So I've drawn four times the same thing. The diagram isn't complete. Look at one of them. Critical point, critical value, and we want a polynomial where the ray at the critical value maps to this ray, to this, to the ray at the critical point, and then back here. What can we, and we have, wait a second, I wanted to map downstairs. Sorry for this. We have the map G here. What can we expect for a diagram from this topological sketch to the actual homomorphic function? So we have the same number of rays. So there should be a homeomorphism here, sending the critical orbit, 1, 2, 3, 4, to the critical orbit. And we've marked the critical orbit here. These are four points. Infinity is a fifth point. These are distinct points. So we can certainly expect that phi sends the postcritical set from one side to the postcritical set on the other side. Then we want the rays like this. We can expect a homeomorphism to send the topological rays, which we just sketched, to the actual rays, or whatever angles we have, of the polynomial. So we can have a homeomorphism from the topology to the complex plane, sending the rays over to the rays. Then these two are, this is the homeomorphisms, these two are both branch coverings, and what do we get upstairs? I already showed you, we get another homeomorphism, phi here. On the postcritical set, there is no problem. We've constructed this. What more can we expect this map phi to realize? Let me especially look at the ray landing at the critical value here. Let me draw it thick, and here also. And here I draw the two pre-images of this one ray, is this ray, and then it's negative, like this. The quadratic map, so the upper half plane, bounded by these two rays, the upper half plane maps homeomorphically to the complement of this ray. And by the same token, the lower half plane maps homeomorphically to the complement of this ray. So we have a homeomorphism from the complement of this ray to the complement of this ray, and we have a homeomorphism from these complements to the upper half planes. So we get the homeomorphism from here to here, from the upper half. By the same token, we get homeomorphisms from the lower halves. And we get, and of course we have a boundary compatibility so that this matches to a homeomorphism of the whole sphere. What do we know about the rays? So we have a homeomorphism. I want to show that phi and psi, they coincide on the postcritical set. I want to show that they're isotopic relative to the postcritical set. The combinatorics of the rays tells you that, or the external angle simply, that up here we have the first ray and the second in the upper half, the third ray is in the lower half, and the last one is here. That will be the same on both sides because we have the same external angles. So we can, if we had the map phi sending rays to rays, then we will have the ray map phi sending rays to rays also. More we don't really know. So we have a homeomorphism psi from the rays to the rays. And now the important observation is that the complement, so we have infinity somewhere here. We have punctures at infinity, the postcritical set, and at those 4 points. And we've connected all the punctures out to the point at infinity. So the map is doing the right thing on the rays, and we don't really know what it's doing on the complement of the rays. But since we've connected from infinity to all postcritical points, the complement in the sphere of the rays is simply connected. Now the question, suppose it was simply a disk. How many homotopy classes are there from the disk to the disk if you fix the boundary? So the lemma that if you know the boundary, on the disk there isn't much to be said anyway. You have a disk and you have enough information that you know the map except for filling in the disk, for which there's a single homotopy class. So this whole construction, that's what we want to get. This was our sketch. This construction specifies enough information that we know after the fact the maps agree on the postcritical set. We might even want them to agree on the rays. But on the complement of the rays, they only agree up to the unique homotopy class. So they agree up to homotopy, well, perhaps the rays. So this is exactly the condition that we have here. So specifying the combinatorics of a polynomial. You see, this is the Thurston diagram. This is F, this is G. These are two homeomorphisms. If we specify the external rays of a polynomial, then we get a homeomorphism here and a homeomorphism there, which we know they agree on the postcritical set, and they agree up to homotopy or isotopy relative to the postcritical set. So the combinatorics that we've put in, the external angle 3 over 15 here, gives us just enough combinatorial information to construct the mapping G here, clear enough so that the uniqueness is simply the homotopy of the map C relative to the postcritical set. So this is one relatively simple example. Another simple example is if you use a Hubbard tree, you do the same thing from inside rather than from outside. Drawing the Hubbard tree of a quadratic polynomial specifies there's a homeomorphism here on the trees rather than the complement, you get one there, and it's the same thing. All this which I try to make explicit here in the case of polynomials, quadratic polynomials, works in exactly the same ways when equally explicit for polynomials of arbitrary degree. Specify all the external angles landing at the critical values and the mapping degrees. Or you specify the Hubbard tree. This was done in the PhD thesis of Alfredo Poirier, student of Milner, who I think wrote it in 93. This was done in the Osei notes under the heading Postmonasvili, in a somewhat different language, which predates Thurston, but it's essentially the same thing. I think Fourier has also worked this out, I think, for trees. You can make this explicit there too, and for general rational mappings, it may be not quite so obvious that this is the right notion. But this has to do with the difficulties of rational mappings. There is no natural coordinate system of the topology, which makes working with rational mappings more difficult than with other maps. And maybe it required the genius of Thurston to see that the condition, which I hope we derived here rather naturally, is the right concept also in greater generality. So this is why the amount of combinatorics that we usually use is just enough to specify what we need for Thurston's theorem. So I hope by now I've sort of clarified the meaning of this theorem here. And I've also given an example, which is that of quadratic polynomials. Any questions at this point? That is a good question. If you have an answer, write a PhD thesis about it. What is the analog of spiders for rational mappings? People are trying to classify rational mappings using Thurston's theorem, and the question is, what is the good combinatorial description? In general, I don't think there is a good answer known. I'm not saying there isn't one. At least I don't know of one. People try to describe rational functions as matings of polynomials. You glue to polynomials. Then there is an answer. And there is somebody who is trying to make this as general as possible. But there are cases when it simply isn't a mating. People try to work it out in terms of captures, whatever that means. So people are trying to develop combinatorial models which describe some rational mappings in terms of combinatorics that can be used. And there's different approaches, coding trees and what have you. But for all I know, there is no ultimate good answer which would classify rational mapping, despite serious efforts of many people on this. That's as much as I can say about it for the moment. Since I don't have very much time left, I'd like to finish up with a movie. Mitsu has kindly contributed his latest version of a program, which in its original ideas goes back to early students of John Hubbard. And it shows that you can actually do this on a computer in an absolutely explicit way. So it's not just an empty construction. And I can also show you an example of a Thurston abstraction in the end. So let's hope whether we get this going. Is it warming up? Yeah. And is it light enough? Do we have to turn down the light? Just hit some randomness around. Yes, that's better. Except the yes. Okay, I see something. So let me try to find the one. Thank you, Mitsu. Which I've just used. 3/15. Up to 1 shouldn't matter much. Initialize. So, here we go. Don't trust the program. 3/15, not 1/5. 3/15 of a full turn is this one. The image is 6/15, which is this. The image is 12/15, which is here, and then comes 9, and back to this one. It's exactly the drawing which we have here. And this sketch isn't much better. And that's the whole point. It needn't be much better. All you need to know is the angles out near infinity. So it's the step down here. And now what it does, I'm not sure whether I have time to explain it, is really lift it one step higher, have a tentative polynomial here, and then try to make it a better polynomial. Thurston's theorem is constructive in the sense that if there exists a Thurston abstraction, too bad. If there isn't, then there's a rational function. You iterate in some space of call it spider space, space of spiders, call it Teichmüller space. You iterate in an appropriate space, and no matter where you start, you will converge to a point which uniquely describes the map you want to have. And that's what we're doing here. The spider space, which is a Teichmüller space, is simply the space of endpoints, four-dimensional complex manifold, up to complex automorphisms, infinity, fix the critical point maybe at zero, and fix, or at minus two, fix the critical value at zero. So it's just two more complex freedoms. These two points should be fixed in your complex coordinate systems, and then those two points here, the complex two-dimensional manifold, plus the topological beta, which is the homotopy class of the legs going out to infinity. And you see, so you could wiggle up to isotopy, wiggle this like this, doesn't matter. So this green resolution is absolutely adequate here. Even though we are modeling continuous data on a discrete machine, it's enough data that we have on the computer. If we keep lifting it here, we're iterating in the position space, and it converges to a unique fixed point. You see a real imaginary part of the critical point here. Difference is going to zero. And now let's lift another 10 times, makes a difference. And then here we can draw the Julia set. And this is the... If you have the Julia set even more, let's see what happens here. This is the Julia set, most of you might know, of 3 over 15. So here we have a quadratic polynomial, the unique quadratic polynomial, where the external ray with angle 3 over 15 lands at the critical value in the appropriate fashion. So this is an example where it works in all cases, unless there's a Thurston obstruction. Let's look at a case with a Thurston obstruction. And it's the one that I've drawn here before. Let's do it, and then we see that we could have expected this. So in this case, it's pre-periodic, and we do the same kind of iteration. And you see, in this case, we have six endpoints, so it's a four-dimensional complex space after normalization. And something is happening here. Do you see a very fat... These are 3 points here. Do you see... Maybe I want to do this again. I want you to see that there are three endpoints here. This one, and one of these here, which the three endpoints converge to each other, which means they're surrounded by an annulus, which grows ever fatter. Have we initialized? Yes. You see them coming? There's a fat annulus in this homotopy class, which is growing fatter and fatter. Okay, so all moduli, all cross ratios converge, or in this case they diverge. These 3 points, no matter what you normalize, converge to the same point. It's the same point, not distinct point. So our map here, what we said, they should coincide. Phi and psi should be the same bijections on the postcritical set. So this is not a Thurston obstruction. But what really happens is that the algorithm finds out that, yes, the red angle 956 says image, 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 lands here, lands there. There are three rays which want to land at the same fixed point. So in this case, like for all polynomials, you can identify the endpoints, glue them together, get a new Thurston mapping with a different postcritical set where the endpoints are identified. And in this case, it is Thurston equivalent to a unique rational mapping, in this case, the polynomial that we wanted to have. And again, we can look at the Julia set. Well, it doesn't... So the Julia set is what you don't see. Here you see it a bit better. Okay, so this is an explicit description. Maybe I will extend my time by 2 minutes to say what has happened here on this program. I wanted to see the back panel. It's going to have to work here. And somewhere there's say an eraser. So, remember the picture from there which is half hidden. I'd like to keep the screen down anyway. So here was the map G, which is a topological map. Here's the map F, which we don't know. Here's the homeomorphism. So what do we do? We have a Riemann, we have a topological sphere with some markings. And we've somehow drawn the data into the complex plane with some finite number of marked points. We've drawn it into the complex plane. And that is simply this spider. We have finitely many curves on this picture, four in this case. Let me go back to the initial picture, 3 over 15. Initialize, lift. Okay, so we have those four rays abstractly here, for example, as in the initial spider, and we have a homeomorphism from the four legs into the Riemann sphere. And if we know the homeomorphism on the four legs, as though we can extend it uniquely to a homeomorphism from the sphere to the sphere, up to isotopy, exactly in the sense of Thurston. So the legs specify uniquely our point in spider space or Thurston space. And that makes this topological space, actually here I want to have the Riemann sphere. It's a map into the Riemann sphere. So it's a point in, phi represents a point in Teichmüller space or in spider space. If you don't know what that means, here's the complex structure. This is just a topological sphere. Phi pulls back this complex structure to a complex structure here. This is a topological map, so you can define a complex structure here, perhaps except at the critical points, of which there's finitely many. So you have a complex structure up here also, lifting this one. So it's a sphere with a complex structure. Every sphere with a complex structure is homeomorphic to the Riemann sphere, except for conformal conjugation. That's the uniformization theorem. There is up to automorphism of the Riemann sphere, a unique homeomorphism, which makes this a conformal isomorphism. Here's the standard Riemann sphere, and here's the complex structure which we've pulled up. So, from here, this is the Riemann sphere, this is the Riemann sphere, this is local conformal isomorphism everywhere, except at the critical points here. The finite many. So this is the rational mapping. Let's wake this guy up a little bit. It's a rational mapping. and if we have written our map as lambda times 1 plus z over 2, this is the general form of a quadratic polynomial. The critical point is at negative 2, the critical value is at 0, and then f of v equals lambda, that's the next point. So we normalize critical point, critical value are negative 2 and 0, and we know the image, critical point, critical value is the next point. If we call this lambda, then this polynomial for the parameter lambda will map the critical value, has the critical value at the same point, so you can pull back everything here by this polynomial. You're lucky that you have few critical points, critical value, so you can write down the map X. So you have a polynomial here. You can calculate all the points, and that's what you do. Otherwise, you would have to have, with the complex structure, defined in terms of the trimic form, if you to pull back, integrate, that's a hassle. I don't know how to do it on a computer, but I think people do. But here it's just a quadratic polynomial which you can solve this particular value. Then you have a new map here. This is a polynomial, but there's no dynamics because the new points here are different from the old points. We don't have a polynomial, unlike before, we don't have a polynomial to begin with. Initially, we had a polynomial, we had a map here, and we used this diagram to conclude this direction. Now, we need this direction, we have this, we have this, we have this, that gives us a polynomial with a different point in spiral space. But so we can keep this going, there's the map G still here, that we have dynamics on the left, there's a map downstairs, C is spiral image of phi, or this map of phi, we get another one, sigma squared of phi, and so on. We can iterate this process. We can iterate this very explicitly here to continue, get more and more points like this, so we have an iteration in Teichmüller space or spiral space. And I have to stop. Last sentence. If we have a fixed point in this space, that means phi and psi are the same maps up to isotopic by definition. So that's the definition of the Thersen equivalence. Then we have that means these points are the same. We are in the setting of the theorem, and we have found our rational function, which is equivalent to the initial map. So relatively easy to see, but I stop here, that having a fixed point is what you need. The fixed point is the of this iteration process is the solution to our problem. So here we have an iteration in this space, and you can show it's contracting. So if there's a fixed point, then no matter where you start, you will eventually converge to the fixed point and find it, like this computer program has shown us. I think I said enough for today. Thank you for your attention. This is a long story. So this... Yes. There are a number of programs. So this one was Mitsu's, but there has been quite a bit of work on these programs. Yuval Fischer wrote an original program for Mac OS 7, which in principle is still working today if you emulate the numerical co-professor at the... So was Yuval the numerical co-professor of Hubbard? You know what I want to say. Okay, and then this is a program by Mitsu along the same ideas, and you should realize that finite amount of combinatorics of data allows this topology to be encoded exactly. Just exactly how you do it, it's non-trivial. You work with this Mitsu's program. There's also a program for exponentials available, including a theorem. So I have to say one more thing. For exponentials, there's a program available which does the same thing for exponential mappings just as well. That works also. I think I should come back to Misha's initial question. He said it only works for... Okay, now you have to suffer it through. It only works for rational mappings, and it only works for post-critically finite ones. So the... This theorem only works for... Surgery can do in many cases, but Thersen's theorem, as stated, requires a post-critically finite... Okay, you can deform it, yes. You can deform it. And a number of people have tried to extend this to greater contexts. One is dropping... Staying with rational mappings, dropping the condition on post-critically finiteness. There's been a long-term project by Tsui with various co-authors, and there was a number of talks by Tan Lei on the topic understanding Tsui. I believe by now there is a manuscript of them trying to make this work in post-critically non-finite but still geometrically finite cases, which are not just perturbations. You're right, you can perturb these, make super-attracting into attracting, but what they do goes beyond that case into settings like disconnected. The perturbations always have a homeomorphic Julia set, especially connected Julia set. You cannot get quadratic polynomials with this connected Julia set, and there's a project by them which is supposed to make them work. I don't think whether it's published, but at least there is work in this direction. There's been work by David Brown, motivated by John Hubbard, an old idea of myself, doing this in the attracting case, which is a perturbation for unicritical polynomials, trying to make this happen also for exponential mappings. Again, I don't know what the state of publication is, but this is David Brown's PhD thesis. And then there is an equally old project, what can I say, about two people in the audience or in this room, one in the audience and one back at a different university, doing the same theory, including the classification for exponential functions, which we believe has potential for greater classes of meromorphic transcendental functions or entire transcendental functions. So this is work in progress. And this is all work in progress that I know which extends the theorem as stated here. Oh, there's a post-singularly infinite case, I should say. Marcus Förster has done this in terms of spiders for exponential functions with infinite singular orbits, where the singular orbits converge towards infinity. So the mapping degree is infinite and the post-singular set is infinite. That's the PhD thesis of Marcus Förster. Thank you for the program, me too.